Good evening, everyone. I'm Michaela Crimmin, Head of Arts here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you here this evening. Tonight's event is the fourth in a series of RSA Arts and Ecology Exchanges, featuring fresh perspectives from the cultural sector on the key challenges of our time, and there's definitely no shortage of those. Arts and Ecology is a project which we run as a partnership with Arts Council England. It consists of an ambitious new website, which will be launched this summer, ongoing discourse, as this evening, and an annual Arts and Ecology Day, which had a successful launch last week at City Hall. But at the heart of the project are international partnerships, including one with Turquoise Mountain, who provided a base and fantastic support for David Cottrell's recent stay in Kabul. And related to this partnership is an association with the Wellcome Trust, who will be exhibiting work by David in October. It is Wellcome who supported David in his trip to Helmand Province with the Royal Army Medical Corps and the Royal Marine Commandos. And we're delighted that curators from both Turquoise Mountain and Wellcome are in the audience tonight. Our other distinguished speaker this evening is Andrew O'Hagan, who is a big hero here, and not least of our chief executive, who was apoplectic that he had to be out of London this evening. But before we hear from David and Andrew, it is my great pleasure to introduce our chair, Professor Mark Nash. Mark is head of the Department for Curating Contemporary Art at the Royal College of Art. He's a well-known specialist in contemporary fine art moving image in avant-garde and world cinema. He was a member of the Documentary 11 curatorial team and the film curator of the 2004 Berlin Biennial, amongst many other activities. Mark said he was going to give short introductions to the speakers, so I won't go on, other than one more thing. He's currently developing a research project on the legacy of the Cold War in cinema, art and architecture. We're delighted that you've been able to join us this evening to help our discussion. So thank you, Mark, and over to you.
Okay, well, thanks, Michaela. yes, that was a very grand introduction, and it should be for the colleagues on right and left. But my job really is to chair the discussion, and so I'm going to be brief now and contribute a little bit later on. David is an artist who works in a range of media, digital, video, audio, interactive media, and so on. He's not just working in photographic images, which he'll be showing you to this evening, and has exhibited quite widely. He was selected for Beck's Features in the ICA in 2002, has worked on a number of public commissions in the UK and internationally, and as Michaela said, is a friend and colleague in the Arts and Ecology Initiative. Andrew is a contributing editor to the London Review of Books and Granter magazine. He's a novelist, having started writing in 95 with his first book, The Missing, Our Fathers in 99, and then most recently the book that he's going to talk a bit about tonight, The Atlantic Ocean, researching the lives of two infantrymen, one British and one American. So I think that's all I really need to say about them, except to point out that they're both involved in different forms of creativity. Andrew as a novelist and writer, David as an artist. And so what they'll be talking about in one way or another is how art and writing respond to war. But they won't necessarily be talking about it in a sort of reflective, mediating way. It's more, they'll be talking more, I think, from their own personal perspective, and we'll hope to explore that dimension in the discussion afterwards. So over to you, David.
Okay, so I'm going to try and quickly compare two completely subjective experiences, and the common link, I suppose, is the fact that I went to both locations as an artist, and I'm now in the process of trying to reflect on both those experiences and link them together to find some kind of space from which to reflect. I'm going to show a few pictures from my first trip in November. I went in November with to Helmand Province, and the only way to get to Helmand Province, really, is with the military. The Wellcome Trust had enabled a relationship to grow with the Royal Army Medical Corps. And I was sent out the very specific brief to try and examine the complexity of the relationship between war and medicine. It's hard to adequately explain how far outside my element I was. I was going to somewhere where I had no experience with the military and I'd never been to Afghanistan. It was an interesting and challenging time, but it became very important, very useful in this context here, because I had the opportunity to return and in a radically different role. So in November, I was dressed up nearly like a soldier and sent out from Bryce Norton with the Air Force to be sent to Camp Bastion. I went on a transport plane, and I was the only passenger, and kind of from this point onwards, really, the whole experience felt slightly surreal and tangential to me. I was there is a novelty to war for most civilians, and I worked out afterwards, I think I'm right in thinking that 1 in 200 members of the population are in the military, so the chance of us bumping into them randomly is quite small. And so that means that there's a level of fantasy and curiosity and caricature which is applied to the military. And I certainly was suffering from all of that when I arrived on this C-17 plane. In theatre, you can arrive and you step forward gradually from things which have some relationship to the world that you know through to an environment which is entirely foreign. And one thing that becomes apparent is that you don't really enter the country that you're about to visit. You enter an extension of the military, which is now based in Afghanistan. I arrived in Kandahar, and from there I travelled forward by Hercules to Camp Bastion. Camp Bastion doesn't appear on any maps. It's not on Google Earth anymore. It was briefly. It's a base which was positioned in the desert above an aquifer. And the idea being really that its importance was that it wasn't near anything else. It meant that for supplying it, it's a challenge, but it meant that it's equidistant from many of the forward operating bases and a natural place to return soldiers who've been injured so that they can be treated there. It's basically a central point from which helicopters span out to Helmand Province forward bases. It's a strange, bleak and slightly beautiful location in a weird way. It's absolutely flat. There's a 6-kilometre wall that goes around it, and you're about 20 kilometres from the nearest or structure of any kind outside. There is something extraordinary about being in a country and having no understanding of the country you're in. And in a way, Camp Bastion had its own vocabulary for building. It was built from containers and tents, and it had structures which appeared to really kind of land here rather than kind of evolve from the country. This is the ammunition dump, and I kind of found myself borrowing bicycles and trying to get my bearings there. My role, which I'll talk about more in November, was not so much to look at the structure here, but to look at this, the problems that doctors have in terms of ethically justifying themselves. But it's hard not to be overwhelmed by the structure. All of the bases are built from HESCO bales, which are basically these proprietary sandbags which arrive flat-packed in any country the British are working in. And the local earth is then poured in and structures are created from them. Supplies are transported around by helicopter or occasionally by road. The problem with road convoys is that they're always getting hit. So the danger for the individuals concerned is massive. Camp Bastion was supplied with fresh milk and with food from which seemed kind of quite diverse. But all of this food and all of the fresh water travelled across the border from Pakistan in long road convoys. For convoys going on further into theatre, to the forward operating bases and to the little patrol bases that were dotted around on strategic vantage points in hostile territory, most of the transport was by Chinook. And you have these helicopters here basically winching food and supplies and plastic forks and spoons forward to soldiers in remote locations. There's something eminently unsustainable about the military. It's not the first concern, although it's interesting because although the environmental footprint isn't the kind of overriding issue for the military, the ability to keep people supplied historically has always been massively important. And this kind of the difficulty of dealing with bottled water, with dealing with being far from home in a place where all of the products and things you're using are essentially generic and British rather than Afghan, is something which gradually becomes more apparent. My role was here. It was trying to understand how it's possible to wear Osprey body armour and carry a machine gun and still have surgeon's tools tucked in it. I spent my time watching doctors and seeing essentially the very physical, first-hand impact of war. It was the impact of war on individuals as opposed to on a culture or society or a landscape. And it was immersive and upsetting and bewildering, because the problem was that for me, my first experience of war was similar to it was essentially my first experience of trauma, of hospital theatres. And I couldn't connect this to anything outside. It was like seeing a car crash seven times a day. And it was I was unable to kind of connect this with any kind of longer-term or strategic vision. Back in England, on Channel 4 and reading The Guardian and things like this, I thought I had good understanding of what was happening in that region and what the British were doing, and things I disagreed with profoundly and things that I agreed with. And when you arrive there, as you get further forward, the interesting thing was that all of that contextual information evaporated, and I found myself watching essentially just the responsive, immediate and urgent attempt to try and save lives. There were civilians, Taliban and British soldiers being hit, and there was this constant, there wasn't enough time really to step back and try and ask enough questions. Well, there wasn't enough information, even if I had managed to ask those questions, as to why these people were being damaged, or how this kind of incredibly primitive activity of people basically firing sharp objects at soft bodies was continuing, and how that could contribute to anything longer term. It wasn't that I became more kind of anti-war when I was there. I'd already been quite anti-war before I got there, but it was more that I found it impossible to rationalise what I was seeing. And back home on my couch, I thought I had rationalised the reason why the military exists, or whether it was a failing society, or whether it was something important. But when I was there, it was really just that I saw the military. I saw the military in abstraction, and I watched as soldiers became patients and returned back to England. From there, I managed to get forward slightly to bases where I was able to actually meet soldiers before they were injured and begin to humanize this uniform community, so that rather than seeing them only as a kind of homogenous group, I recognized that obviously they are diverse individuals, most of them very young, and all of them wrestling to try and understand whether there is a justification to what they're doing. There is this kind of cliche, which I've mentioned to other people, but it's that you fight for the person next to you, and that's the reason why people will charge into battle, and it's been the same since the First World War, the Crimea, or whatever. But there is a problem which I think happens longer term, and many soldiers are thinking about the future. Strangely, ironically, people that are concerned about what's going to happen in the next 12 hours are talking about pensions and about what they'll do when they leave. They know it's a short career. And also, they're anxious to make, when they have seen somebody injured or hurt or killed, that somehow, looking back, they'll find there's a justification which somehow compartmentalizes this and allows them to feel that it was valid. And that's the great unknown. And in a way, that's a great fear which is unspoken. I managed to see Afghanistan briefly, over the top of sandbags and through razor wire. I didn't meet any Afghans apart from the translators, and none of them were from this province. They were all from Kabul in the north, and they told me that the north was a different country and that I shouldn't attempt to try and extrapolate from Helmand province. From Lashkargah, where I met civil servants that were there for slightly longer, I went forward to a place where there were no civilians, to Sangin Valley and to the Sangin DC base, where essentially the suspicion of individuals beyond the base is total, and people feel that they're constantly under threat of attack. It is a beautiful country, and there was something frustrating and exhausting about not being able to step into it and not being able to understand anything of what's beyond there. The soldiers do 6-month tours of duty, so although they have money to try and influence local infrastructure and to try and win consent, as it's called, they will never be able to see the legacy of any projects which they might start. And each 6 months there is a kind of handover, which essentially means starting from scratch in many cases. The move from military to civilian authority was something I couldn't see there. I couldn't see any way in which it could happen. And what was interesting was that I saw something which paralleled in some ways what I saw later on, was that there was a feeling of a necessity to be accountable by the military, to kind of prove to their superiors, who would probably be able to prove to the government ministry, that they had actually spent money and made an impact on the ground. The problem was that there was no bureaucracy, there was no civil servants, and that Helmand province particularly had been an area which had been governed by warlords, and certainly any kind of vestige of government had been removed over 30 years of previous conflict. People who were powerful, in terms of people that were landowners or people that had a lot of guns or had proven themselves and somehow, essentially either from being a mafia boss or through being a good representative to their local villages, attended shuras with the military. And this Major Cheeseman at this point was about to introduce that he had $1 million to give to Sangin Valley. And the whole shura was quiet. People listened carefully. They were interested, of course. But as soon as it was over, people ran to this man, who was responsible for compensation. And essentially, it made sense. People were told there was $1 million to build roads or schools or long-term infrastructure, but they didn't believe necessarily the British were going to win. And they'd seen it happen before with the Russians, and they'd seen it happen before with other organizations. Even the Taliban were building schools. And it was what was immediate and essential for them was to try and get some recompense at that moment, something short-term. It was, my farm has been destroyed, or my vehicle has been destroyed. I need the money to replace it. And essentially what's happening is that long-term planning for the military and for the people living around it is an incredible challenge. I returned last month to go to Kabul. And this was for several reasons. The RSA had suggested that it was possible for me to go there, and it would be appropriate to try and extend this strange kind of side issues in a way which were not part of the brief for the War on Medicine research to do with and to try and understand how conflicts and how the exhaustion of materials and the complete devastation of a natural kind of commerce and infrastructure could be explored further by returning. It was also personally valuable because it allowed me to try and view the experience I had with the military from outside. And the whole time I was there, although I became close to the individuals and I felt I had some understanding, people were confiding me, I had no idea whether what I was seeing was purely military or if it related to the military's relationship with Afghanistan. Kabul was amazing, and this was the first moment I stepped outside a vehicle into Afghanistan. I'd never actually touched the soil in Afghanistan. I'd travelled to Afghanistan in military bases, military vehicles, and occasionally I'd had to run from a flight line where a helicopter dropped us into a base. But apart from those few steps, I never walked freely. In Kabul, it was possible to actually walk and to begin to understand some of the things that you could only see with a telephoto lens from the military. It is interesting that the mud architecture, the ruins, and the kind of beautiful landscape over here begins to reveal some of the challenges that Afghanistan's facing and some of the things which it's impossible for the military to really deal with. In Kabul, there is a lack of sewers, and although there are green spaces like this, when the land is irrigated, it's very fertile. There is also a problem with the fact that many of the trees have long since disappeared. The trees on these mountains, I was told, were removed partly just because if people don't know if they're going to be shelled the next day, they're going to use whatever wood they've got to burn. They're going to kill the livestock they've got to eat, and they're not going to be necessarily planting crops. But also, because the trees offered kind of defensive positions for people firing back onto Kabul. And it's only recently that people have considered planting again. But wood is massively important in the rebuilding of these traditional homes. And it's interesting that the wood is coming from somewhere else. It's not very obvious where it's coming from, but it's certainly well outside Kabul. Roads are being widened because congestion is massive, and this is a road widening project. It's kind of quite dramatic, and people are still living in some of these buildings. But the interesting thing is that life is going on, and that what I'd seen in Sangin, which was of a country where there was no possibility of witnessing any kind of normal commerce or normal life on the street, was actually happening in Kabul. It was essentially a kind of a hopeful possibility. The difficulty was trying to relate what the military were doing up there to what people were doing on the ground, and it was I don't think I really understood this entirely, but I did manage to begin to see how, as the boundaries break down and as civilian authorities become more important, the military look more redundant. And I'm not sure if that was just because I was outside the military or because I was in a different context. As you climb hills, when you get to the top, to get a beautiful view of Kabul, there aren't very good maps, so it helps to actually look down from above. You often find soldiers that are camped up there. But it's very different from actually kind of only arriving on these hills by helicopter or only kind of racing above them. The whole of Afghanistan, the places that I visited, had evidence of war. And there was an interesting thing where as you travel across the country, you see the signs for HALO, for the mine clearance company, charities, and for Omar. And you get a sense of a landscape that has been poisoned. But it's also interesting to see that gradually, somehow, this land is being kind of brought back to life slowly. This place here was the Russian Camp Bastion. It had 3,000 Russians staying there before. And it's interesting that when you arrive there now, there are 3 Afghans living there. And the place is basically being reclaimed by the desert. They were slightly further ahead. They built concrete structures and not tents. But as I progressed forward into across the north of the country, and I managed to visit places like Mazar-e Sharif, you see evidence of the profound trauma which has been visited on the whole country as opposed to individuals. And it's this was a town which used to be on the hippie trail, the great tourist trail, absolutely destroyed, and the market has moved to new buildings which kind of exist just beyond it, but the town was abandoned. As you travel through Afghanistan, you see the legacy of fighting, and you see areas which potentially still have the ability to be reactivated. And I suppose the great issue is whether the NGOs and whether the vast amounts of money being poured in can actually interact with this landscape, whether it can affect the and somehow deter the resurgence of war, or the allow for the normal life which should exist within this landscape to actually reappear. I found myself kind of attracted by these sublime landscapes, by it's the most profoundly beautiful place. And the interesting thing is that there is a perception which you apply to a landscape when you've been with the military, where you assume that everything is dangerous. And obviously that's justified to some extent. But it is interesting. In some areas, we were walking on foot and local people were talking to us, and we saw armoured convoys coming past with people holding on to machine guns. And we recognised that the experience, the relationship with the location had to be radically different. In Mazar-e Sharif, we were invited into the mosque, and we travelled through markets and began to see the containers that had been brought here by the USA and others being reclaimed to make market shops, and new stalls being created by local people. But whether these would actually be active or not was yet to be understood. The difficulty I had, although I could see the redundancy of military architecture and the tanks from the Russian era being littered across the landscape, was to understand how the billions being poured in through national governments, through the World Bank, could ever really kind of affect this landscape, how they could reach down south. There were people kind of carrying, this is kind of important, this image in a way, because he's carrying an Afghan flag, which in Helmand was absolutely a risky thing to do. But there are infrastructure problems which are so vast. And the pollution of the main river, the pollution in the air, and the landscape, which appears to be essentially redundant at the periphery of Kabul. The problem is that the NGOs have to make an impact. They have to be able to account back to the national governments, to the international bodies that they're working for, and they have to prove that the money is being well spent. There have been massive signature projects, like the Olympic Stadium that was built by the UN, and the Taliban, it appeared, were softening because they allowed this to happen. Of course, it was famously used for executions. And it was the same with the swimming pool there. So there are projects which are currently happening to try and clear these 2 or 3 meters of rubbish from the landscape here. And it's, I suppose, the difficulty here for me was to understand how any of this could happen without the bureaucracy and the infrastructure which we came to know and understand in Britain. There was while the money was there, and while people were working hard to try and do good things, the difficulty was that the Afghan government was appearing more and more futile. And while if the UN or the World Bank wanted to actually get the results, there was a lack of trust for the Afghan government to be able to deliver it. And never before had I felt so profoundly in favour of some form of bureaucracy. But without a delivery engine, it was impossible for me to understand how any of this money could actually reach local people. What happened was that people would stamp their logo onto the great things that were happening. So a new school, a new hospital, a new road, a new bridge would have a gift from the people of Italy or a gift from the people of America. And the problem for that was that for Karzai and for the central government, it makes it look like the only kind of things which are powerful will happen outside the government. There was a mismatch, in a way, between the shift of power. And it appeared that while people might be pleased with the infrastructure projects and the things happening, the only things which could really appear to offer any form of long-term stability was if a government locally, which was had to stay there and had a long-term investment in the place, took ownership of these projects. The Omar Landmine Museum, the emergency hospital, I gradually found organisations that were active in Helmand. And while I was standing there in Lashkargah or in Sangin Valley looking out, assuming that there's no activity there, I was wrong. It was interesting. It's just that those organisations were scared of having contact with the military. And while we all convinced ourselves that the only primary healthcare, the only kind of services and the only things which were being done for people in Helmand province were done by the military, it wasn't entirely true. Emergency Hospital, Ibn Sina, Omar and Halo were active, just very quietly working with local people beyond the walls. And when I went to meet with them in Kabul, it was interesting because on the outside you have a kind of a basic facade which just says no weapons, and you have a guard there who doesn't actually carry a gun, stopping people come in. When you pass through the doors, you find these oases. And it was a strange wake-up call. The military, I didn't believe, were redundant. I didn't believe it was pointless. And my conclusions coming out of this were that I couldn't make a conclusion. I couldn't be sure. But it was also that there was something missing in the chain between the six-month intensive experience of people responding to people firing at each other and the two-year or the 10-year or the generational change that was necessary to have any kind of long-term impact on Afghan soil. This is an American poster showing the landscape that they've supported and the landscape just behind it.